It's time for justice. Welcome to our special one-hour live broadcast of the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show about Virginia's 2010 legislative session. I'm your host, Marty Wegbright. This show is heard every Wednesday on 97.3 FM WRIR and is written and produced by Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. We give free, civil, non-criminal legal aid to low-income people in Richmond, Petersburg, Charlottesville, and surrounding cities and counties. In this week's one-hour special, we'll be talking with Virginia Poverty Law Center attorneys Jay Spear, Christy Mara, and Sushila Varkey about consumer, foster care, domestic violence, and other family law issues confronting the General Assembly next year. Stay with us. The show is supported in part by a grant from the Virginia Law Foundation. This show, number 67, is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society and gives only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford an attorney, we'll tell you later in the show how to get free legal advice or representation in a civil case. The Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show is heard every Wednesday at 12:30 on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio, and is made possible by community radio volunteers at WRIR. We're back with our special one-hour live broadcast of the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show about Virginia's 2010 legislative session, and we'll be talking with Virginia Poverty Law Center attorney Jay Spear about consumer law issues confronting the General Assembly next year. Welcome to the show, Jay.
Thanks, Marty. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for being here. Jay, would you tell our listeners just briefly, what do you do at the Virginia Poverty Law Center?
Well, the Poverty Law Center is a nonprofit law firm, and our primary duty is to work with the legal aids around the state that provide, like such as Central Virginia Legal Aid, that provide free legal services to folks. And the way we work with them is we help them with their cases and do training and that sort of thing. But probably the main reason I'm on today is because we also do policy work on broad issues that affect low-income people in Virginia.
And I know that your area is consumer law, and the last couple of years in the General Assembly, the big consumer law issue has been payday lending. What's it going to be this year, Jay?
Well, I hate to say it because I'm getting a little tired of this issue. This is my 10th year at the General Assembly, and every single year I've had to fight these predatory lending issues, including payday lending. This year, probably it's not going to be payday lending, but it's going to be sort of the cousin of payday lending called car title lending, which is another predatory lending product.
And tell our listeners briefly, what is car title lending? How does that work?
Well, the way it works is you've probably seen their advertisements on TV and on the radio and all that sort of thing. They come in, no credit check. And when they advertise on TV, they say, you know, come in and we'll loan to anybody, and you can even keep your car. But the way it works is you come in and you want to borrow, let's say, $1,000. As I say, they won't do a credit check. You have to bring your car in. Now, most of the car title lenders won't loan to you unless you don't have any liens on your car, but we're now finding that some of them will loan to you even if you already have a lien on your car. They'll take a look at your car, and then they'll tell you if they can loan you $1,000. They typically do it based upon the value of the car. If the car is worth more than – usually it's based upon 50% of the wholesale value of the car. So if your car is worth $2,000 wholesale, they'll loan you $1,000. Then you'll have to sign documents which obligate you to pay typically anywhere from 300 to 400% interest.
Is that per year?
Yes, that's per year. So they typically charge they do a good job usually of misleading folks into thinking it's 25 or 30% a year when it's typically that's what it is per month.
So, Jay, how can that possibly be legal? I mean, I thought at some level there was still usury laws or laws that limited interest rates. How can these car title lenders possibly be charging 300% to 400% per year interest?
Well, Virginia does have a usury law like most states, and we've had usury laws for decades, if not centuries. And most small loans in Virginia are, by small, I mean small dollar amounts, are limited to 36% annual interest, which is a high interest rate in itself. But these, of course, are almost 10 times as much as that. But what they're doing is they're using an exception to our usury law for loans that are open-end. And by open-end, it's open-end credit. It's referring to if you borrow money and there's no set time to repay it, but you pay it's like a credit card. You pay a minimum payment each month. Then they're pretending they're open-end, although I disagree legally that they really are open-end. But that's the artifice they're using to get around our usury laws.
So in other words, you're putting your car up basically to stand good for this loan, but they're pretending it's like an open-end credit card.
That's exactly right. And in fact, they will make a copy of your keys when you get the loan so they can easily repossess your car. And they do repossess a lot of cars. It's amazing how many.
So what's the proposal here for dealing with this? I mean, first of all, how big of a problem is this? How many car title lenders are out there? How many folks are losing their cars because they can't make these payments?
Well, the trouble is you really don't know how many car title lenders there are or how many loans they're making or how many cars they're repossessing. Because, believe it or not, they're totally unregulated. They don't report to anybody. If you have a complaint about a car dealer, there's no state agency you can complain to, because anybody operating under this open-end credit statute is not subject to any regulation. Now, we have gotten some information from the Department of Motor Vehicles who, when they put a lien on your car, they typically have to record it with the Department of Motor Vehicles. And we've seen indications that they repossess as many as 6,000, 7,000, 8,000 cars a year in Virginia.
Wow, that is quite a huge number. So what is the solution for dealing with this problem?
Well, we think the solution is to cap the interest rate. Essentially, what we want to do is bring them back under the small loan interest rate cap of 36%, which has been in place in Virginia, as I say, for decades. And it doesn't make any sense to us if you are, particularly when you give a loan that has security, meaning that if the person doesn't repay the loan, you can take their car. It doesn't make any sense that they need to charge more than 36% interest in order to make a profit.
Now, you mentioned earlier that these loans are set up in a way that looks like an open-end credit, like a credit card, but in fact, they're really more like closed-ended, and there's some sort of disclosures that folks should be getting and aren't getting. Are there ways that people can get out of these car title loans?
What I would suggest if you get into one of these loans is to call our hotline for advice and consultation, and that number is 1-866-830-4551. If you call that number, you'll reach somebody in the Virginia Poverty Law Center office. We'll talk to you about your loan. We may be able to give you some advice about how to get out of it. It's tough to get out of a car title loan without a lawyer. So we will sometimes we'll try to find a legal aid lawyer that'll take the case, or maybe there are a few private attorneys. But I would definitely suggest calling that hotline if you're in trouble with a car title loan.
Okay, well, that's great. And again, that number is 1-866-830-4551. Well, I gather that payday lending hasn't exactly gone away. Is that going to still be an issue before the 2010 General Assembly?
Yeah, well, I think it's going to be because we have in Virginia Virginia Payday Loan Act, which passed in 2002, which puts some restrictions on the payday lenders, but it doesn't really restrict the interest rate. It's still 300%, 400%, and even 500% interest. But in 2008, we had a big fight over payday lending. We tried to cap it at 36%. We ended up with somewhat of a compromise, which put more restrictions on the payday lenders. And that law went into effect on January 1st, 2009, this year. And what the payday lenders did is they decided they didn't like that law, and so they weren't going to comply with it. And so what they did is they took – and typically payday lenders have people that come in every single pay period, sometimes for months, sometimes for years. And when the person came in to renew their loans in December and January, they just flipped them into these new products. The new products are called lines of credit, or they have you sign a line of credit agreement. What they've decided to do is use the same statute that the car title lenders are using and make these appear to be open-end loans. And now, essentially, these folks are involved in a 300% credit card.
Without actually having a credit card or the ability to go somewhere and use that line of credit, I gather.
Right, yeah. Typically, your line of credit would be, say, for $1,000, and you get $1,000 right up front. And then you're required to pay a minimum payment, which is typically just the interest of maybe 25% a month. So you borrow $1,000, your interest only would be about $250 a month, if you can believe that. And then most people get behind or they can't afford it. And before you know it, it's not uncommon to see people owing twice what they borrowed, even though they've paid maybe the entire loan back. It becomes a quicksand or a quagmire that people cannot get out of. And I think what's going to happen, there's probably going to be legislation this year to try to rein that in, try to bring the payday lenders back under the Payday Loan Act and stop them from this dodge of trying to get around that. Payday lending is way down in Virginia, 85% from last year.
And is that because of the action the General Assembly took last year, the I guess, quote, reforms that took place in 2008?
It's two things. It's partly because of that, and some of the payday lenders have left the state. One of the second biggest payday lender in the state has actually left Check and Go.
I think we did a segment on that. Check and Go is now Check and Gone.
Right, exactly. But probably the biggest reason that payday lending is down is because payday lenders have switched to these open-end loans, whether it's the line of credit or a lot of them have also started doing the car title loans as well.
Okay, so the plan is to put the same type of regulations on these lines of credit that are currently on the, quote, closed end old payday loans, where you give them a check and they hold the check for 2 weeks. Is that the plan?
Well, that's one possibility, or another possibility is to try to start regulating these open-end loans and put an interest rate cap on them.
And again, what interest rate cap are we talking about?
We're talking about the 36% cap, which most people will tell you that they think that's way too high, but that's about one-tenth of what they're charging now.
Now, of course, just to play devil's advocate a little bit here, obviously the payday lending lobby, and I'm sure you've heard this a million times, says we're just making credit available to people who otherwise wouldn't be able to get it. We're doing a service. Nobody has to use our service. What do you say in response to that?
Well, the first thing I would say is nobody should look at this as a service. Anybody that would charge you 300% interest on a loan is not doing you a service. They're doing you a disservice. Where a lot of people go to a payday lender because they don't have the money to fix their car or they are having trouble paying their rent or something. And yes, initially it may help you make that payment, but it won't be long, 2 months, 1 month, 3 months, and you'll be in much more debt than what you started out being, and it could be a much bigger problem than it ends up making your problem much, much worse. So they really don't provide any kind of a service. And when, you know, a lot of people tell me that they're very good at confusing you about what you're actually paying, and so payday lenders, for example, are very good at making you think it's a two-week loan. If you go get a payday loan, for instance, it'll say on the paperwork, the person, backing up a little bit, the person in the store will tell you over and over again, this is $15 per hundred. And so you're thinking 15%. And then when you get the paperwork, if you look at it, which is usually extensive paperwork, it'll tell you 350% or something. Most people either don't see it, or if they do see it, they may ask about it, and their payday loan employee will be trained to tell you, well, that's only if you're going to have the loan for a year. This is just a short-term loan. That doesn't apply. So they're very good at the kind of stuff they can tell you to divert your attention.
So what alternatives do you suggest for folks who want to get credit but shouldn't be going to these predatory lenders? What should they do if they're facing a cash shortage situation?
Well, what people should do is the same thing they've done for decades before we had payday lending, and that is if you're behind on a bill, you should call your creditor, see if you can get more time to pay. If you're really in a bind, you may have to go to a church or a family member or a neighbor or whatever to borrow money in a short term. You may want to go to a credit union. Credit unions do a lot of small loans for folks that are members, and it's everyone out there can be a member of a credit union. It's just a matter if you go on the Virginia Credit Union's website, you can find out which credit unions you can join. And credit unions do a lot of this. But keep in mind that for a lot of people in a financial bind, a loan is just not the answer. If you owe lots of money and you're behind on your bills, it usually doesn't make sense to borrow more money, because all that does is get you into further trouble.
In other words, you really cannot borrow your way out of debt.
That's right.
Well, the other issue that I know you wanted to talk about is something called the Service Members Relief Act and some reforms to that. Would you tell our listeners first, what is the Service Members Civil Relief Act?
Sure. That's a federal law that protects our active duty service members. And it's essentially a sort of a extra protection for service members when they get involved in certain legal transactions. To give you an example, and the reason for this is if service members are suddenly deployed to Afghanistan or Iraq or whatever, and let's say that you've signed a year lease, and 3 months into the lease, you're told you're going to Afghanistan next week. Well, you need to get out of that lease, and what this federal law does is give those folks the right to get out of that lease.
Okay. So what is the proposal to improve the act?
Well, the problem with the federal law is that the only way to enforce it if the law is violated is to go to the U.S. attorney and ask them to do something. And as you can imagine, U.S. attorneys have lots of stuff on their plate, and it's tough for them to enforce the law. What our proposal would do is the same thing that a lot of consumer protection statutes do, it offers a fee-shifting way of enforcing it. But what I mean by that is if somebody doesn't comply with the act, you would have the right to bring a lawsuit against that business or person, and your lawyer gets paid by the bad guy. And that's the way we enforce a lot of laws in this country.
So even though this is a federal statute, you're proposing a Virginia statute to try to help people enforce it if it is violated by, let's say, a creditor, a bank, a landlord, something like that.
Right. So essentially what the legislation would do is say if you violate this federal law, that is a violation of our Virginia Consumer Protection Act, which is the law that says, and in fact, there's a long list of laws that if you violate are also a violation of the Consumer Protection Act, which means that the person who is harmed can get an attorney to help them, and that person can bring an action and enforce the law. And in addition, it gives our state attorney general the right to bring cases against somebody who's involved in widespread abuse of consumers.
Now, are there other states that have done this, that have basically passed a state law to allow people to enforce a violation of the Service Members Civil Relief Act?
I'm not aware of whether other states have done it or not. I know Senator McCain wanted to do this on the federal level. I think he had legislation in last year, but for some reason it didn't make it through.
Okay. So this really is an issue that cuts across party lines. I mean, who could possibly be against allowing our servicemen to protect themselves against violations of this act?
I agree with that. And in fact, I would say the same thing for all these consumer issues. They really are bipartisan issues. And we have legislators that help us from both sides of the aisle.
Thanks for talking with us, Jay. We've been talking with Virginia Poverty Law Center attorney Jay Speer about consumer law issues confronting the General Assembly next year. We'll be back in a moment. Keep on a-talkin', marchin' up the freedom land. You're listening to our special one-hour live broadcast of the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio, about Virginia's 2010 legislative session. And now we'll be talking with Virginia Poverty Law Center attorney Christy Mara about consumer law and foster care issues confronting the General Assembly next year. Welcome to the show, Christy.
Thanks, Marty. Thanks for having me here.
You're welcome. And please tell our listeners briefly, what do you do at the Virginia Poverty Law Center?
Well, as Jay told you earlier, we provide case support and training to all of the legal aid attorneys throughout the state. And we also provide training to some of what we would call lay advocates. In my case, because I work on child welfare issues, for example, I do some work with local and statewide social workers and others that deal with children in foster care.
Okay, so that's your big issue is foster care, but I understand this year you're going to be carrying the torch for a couple of consumer law proposals as well. Tell us about those.
Oh, I'd be glad to, Marty. The first one deals with a practice that came to our attention from a number of different local legal aids in the state, including Central Virginia Legal Aid. And the situation that was brought to the local legal aid attorneys was this. Clients who had judgments against them for money amounts were having their bank accounts frozen by creditors who were attempting to collect the judgments. Now, the problem with that was that these judgment debtors, which is what we call people who owe money through a court order to a creditor, they were not receiving any notice that some of the money in their account, or perhaps all of it, might not be money that creditors were allowed to take under Virginia law.
Well, now there is a garnishment statute that when a garnishment summons is issued to collect on a judgment, whether it's garnishing your wages or garnishing your bank account, that notice has to be given to your employer or your bank and then notice to the debtor. But apparently you're talking about a different process entirely.
That's right, Marty. Normally, the garnishment statute, which you're referring to, would be used to garnish these bank accounts. And under that statute, the debtor would get a notice saying, hey, if you've got any of these types of money in your account, such as child support, such as Social Security benefits, the creditor cannot take those, and you can file a motion to have that money returned to you, and we'll give you a hearing. And in fact, we'll give you a hearing within 7 days.
And you even get a form allowing you to do that.
Absolutely. So it's very user-friendly for people who don't have lawyers, for example. In these cases, the creditors were using something that they called a notice of lien, and the law says you've got to send that notice to the bank and send a copy to the debtor, but it doesn't require that those notices regarding what money cannot be taken by the creditor, or that there be a form provided to allow the debtor to ask for a hearing to get the money back, be provided. None of that has to be provided to the debtor. So what's been happening is, debtors have been finding out, going into the bank, trying to write a check or going in to withdraw funds. The bank's been saying, that's been frozen. There's a lien on your account. And they haven't had any idea whether or not or how to unfreeze their accounts. A few did seek out advice from local legal aid attorneys who were able to go into court, file a motion to have that lien dismissed in cases where the money was exempt funds that couldn't be taken by creditors.
So what's the proposal here? I mean, is there any reason to allow these two methods of collecting a debt by freezing a bank account, one being the garnishment that has all those protections and the other being this notice of lien that doesn't? Is there any reason to keep these two side by side?
Well, we met with some creditors' attorneys about that, actually, and what they explained was that there are some cases where they'd like to be able to use that notice of lien mechanism. They're not the cases that we're concerned about. And so what we've decided to try to what we're supporting is a change that would require the same types of notices, the same right to a hearing, the same form in these notice of lien cases as are currently required in the garnishment cases.
Okay, I see. So basically making both procedures more or less identical, using the garnishment procedures as a model for the notice of lien procedure.
That's exactly the goal.
Now, the other method that is used to collect judgments, although it's not very common at all, is, and a lot of people are worried about this, mm-hmm. is their house and land getting mm-hmm. sold out from mm-hmm. under them. Mm-hmm. Is that something that is of concern to folks? And if so, how do we propose to deal with that?
Yeah, it's absolutely of concern to folks. And what happens, again, we're talking about folks who have judgments against them, and there's something called a judgment lien that can be placed on the home, and that can stay there, and when that home is sold or when somebody dies and the home is transferred, then the creditor can collect his or her money from the sale of the home. But there's this not very often used mechanism in the law that would allow a creditor with a judgment lien to ask the court, hey, can you sell this right now? We want to sell the property now and collect our money now instead of waiting. And in those cases, the debtors could become homeless because they're forced out of their home. A lot of people are surprised to know that there's nothing presently in the law that absolutely allows someone to protect their home from this type of action.
I see. So this is not done very often, I gather.
No, it's not. But we have heard of a few cases fairly recently within the past year or two where it has happened.
And how often is it used as a threat against a judgment debtor to get them to pay a judgment for fear of losing their home?
Well, I think that certainly does happen a lot more often than it's actually used. And I think the other thing that happens is that the debtors become aware, of course, that this lien is on their home. And when they contact, for example, your office or one of the other local legal aides, there's no way to assure them that there absolutely won't be a motion by the creditor to sell their home. And so this can cause folks some real worries, and unnecessarily so in many cases.
And unnecessarily so, because I gather the judgment is a lien or a claim on the home. It's going to continue to draw interest, and maybe, what, 5, 10,
right.
15 years down the road, the home will be sold. There'll be money to pay the judgment right. with interest.
Right, exactly.
So what's the proposal to reform this?
Well, it's a proposal that really focuses on protecting people with low incomes. And what it says is, the idea is for folks who have household incomes under $50,000 a year, and that would be a combined household income of everybody in the household, not just the judgment debtor, that for those folks, the proposal says you can't force a sale of their home, even if you have a lien. You've got to wait. And it's a very balanced approach because, as you pointed out, by waiting, the creditor will continue to collect interest on that debt that is owed to him or her.
So you mentioned that you discussed the other proposal to rein in or reform the notice of lien with creditor's attorneys. Have you discussed this proposal also with creditor's attorneys?
We have.
And what reaction are we getting from them?
Somewhat mixed, but they, we're still talking, we're still having ongoing conversations about it in the hopes that we can iron out the whatever concerns they might have and still provide that basic protection that the change would give to debtors and homeowners.
Okay. Well, I know that your big issue, the one that you really deal with more, is foster care.
That's
and I know
right.
that several years ago there was the study from the Pew Research Foundation that said, unfortunately, Virginia had the worst foster care system in the nation. Can you tell us, has things changed since then? How are we doing compared to other states?
Well, things have changed. As you know, Marty, the First Lady had a large initiative, which she called her For Keeps Initiative, that began, I guess, about 2 or more years ago. And the goal there was to provide more permanent homes to youth in foster care so that fewer would be what's called aging out of the system. Youth age out of the system when they reach age 18, 19, 20, they're still in foster care. And then when they leave, they're really legal orphans. They have no parents or family to rely upon. The percentage of youth who age out of the system has gone down. The overall number of youth in foster care, as a result of the initiatives of the First Lady and something else called the Child Welfare Transformation that's been ongoing for the past year to 18 months, and I can tell you a little bit more about that in a minute, but as a result of those things, the number of youth in foster care has gone down from about 8,000 to about 6,500, I believe, in Virginia. And what that tells us is that there are more youth being adopted, there are more youth going home to their birth families with proper supports in place so that they'll remain safe with those families.
So I gather there's a proposal to help these youth who are aging out of foster care to allow some sort of services to continue until their 21st birthday. Would you talk to us about that?
Right. There are presently services that are provided to some older youth in foster care that will help them as they move out of care, whether they leave at 19, 20, or 21. And these include the full array of services: help finding housing, help with education, mental health services. Right now, the law allows local departments of social services to provide these services, but it does not require them to do so. And what we'd like to see is for all of the local departments of social services to be required to provide these services to youth until they reach age 21. Because right now, if you're a youth in one locality, you may get these services for 3 extra years, as opposed to youth in another locality where the locality may say, I'm sorry, you're 18 now, and send them off.
And I assume there are definite long-term as well as probably medium-term and short-term benefits to providing these services.
Absolutely. What studies have shown, and there was a big study out in the Midwest not too long ago, and what they've shown is that youth who get these continued services until age 21 tend to have higher incomes than youth who age out earlier, and they tend to stay in school longer.
Okay. Well, changing gears again, I know one of the issues that you deal with is divorce, and I know there are proposals to make divorce somewhat easier to get in Virginia because it's certainly not easy to do right now. Could you lead our listeners just kind of briefly through the process to get a divorce in Virginia?
Sure. There are actually quite a few hurdles, even for what I call a simple no-fault divorce. There are divorces that are based on somebody doing something bad to the other spouse, and I'm not talking about those. There are also divorces that are based on simply two folks who have been married saying, this isn't working out, and we don't want to be married anymore. Right now, the law says if they, particularly if they have children, but they have been separated for at least 12 months, that's all they need to prove to be able to get a divorce. But it's the way that you have to actually access the system and provide the proof that can create some hurdles. There are pleadings that have to be filed. You have to actually give testimony either in court or in something called a deposition, which requires a court reporter and can really get rather expensive, even for someone who has chosen to or is not able to pay an attorney. There are other expenses that can be barriers to moving forward.
Okay, so let's talk sort of specifically about the proposal that we have to make it a little simpler and then talk more generally about mm-hmm. the problem of people maybe possibly being able to do this mm-hmm. on their own. Mm-hmm. I mean, right now, when a divorce is filed and the other side, the defendant, is served and gets the pleadings, you would think you wouldn't have to do anything more, mm-hmm. but apparently that's not the mm-hmm. case.
Well, and we're talking specifically in this proposal about situations where the defendant receives the pleadings and says, I don't care. I'm not going to do anything about this, and does nothing more, which is fine. The problem is that in some parts of the state, judges are requiring the plaintiffs, the person who filed the lawsuit in those cases, to continue to go through certain formal hoops to give notices to the defendant of, for example, those depositions I mentioned earlier of the actual signing of the divorce decree. And when they do that, they have to schedule a hearing, et cetera. What we're trying to do is to clarify that in cases where the defendant has been served and says, I don't really care, the plaintiff doesn't have to go through these other formal service of documents on the defendant. So it's a pretty straightforward thing. I think everybody's in agreement on this one, and we hope it'll move forward.
So that sounds like something that will be fairly uncontroversial. Mm-hmm. What about the more general problem of just people being able to file divorces and get divorces mm-hmm. on their own by mm-hmm. themselves without mm-hmm. an attorney?
It's a big problem that right now, because there are all of these hurdles and formalities you have to go through, it's very hard to finish those without hiring an attorney. A lot of our low-income clients obviously can't afford to hire an attorney, and many of them will stay separated but not divorced for years and years and years, which can impact certain, you know, opportunities to get certain financial resources, for example. Other states have processes which allow, and laws which allow folks to simply go online, for example, and fill out forms and sign something called an affidavit, which is a sworn written statement instead of live testimony, to allow them to get divorced. We're not quite there yet in Virginia, but what we are, a group of folks from different legal aid organizations, are working on is getting all of these forms that I'm talking about in one set standard style, getting them up on the internet, and getting them into a program that folks could access and fill out themselves, so that the forms would be generated by the computer and they could then just go on down and file. And then also we're working with some local courts to set up certain days every month that would be sort of what we call no-fault divorce days, where you can go in and just give your testimony live in court without having to pay for a court reporter. So it's way down the road still, but we're working on it.
So in other words, you didn't need a lawyer to get married. You shouldn't need one to get a simple, uncontested, no-fault divorce.
That's our position, Marty. You said it well.
Okay. Well, thank you. Thank you for speaking with us, Christy. We have been talking with Virginia Poverty Law Center attorney Christy Mara about consumer law and foster care and divorce issues confronting the General Assembly next year. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to our special one-hour live broadcast of the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio, about Virginia's 2010 legislative session. And now we'll be talking with Virginia Poverty Law Center attorney Sushila Varkey about domestic violence issues confronting the General Assembly next year. Welcome to the show, Sushila.
Thank you, Marty. It's great to be here.
Well, tell our listeners briefly what work you do at the Virginia Poverty Law Center.
Okay, Marty. Well, I think differently from Jay and Christy. I do all the trainings and that type of work. I follow the legislature on the types of issues that affect my clients. But I tend to get a lot of calls from individuals as well as advocates about their particular cases, and those are domestic and sexual violence cases. So in the General Assembly, I tend to follow not just domestic violence and sexual violence laws, but also the firearms issues. I try to keep abreast of those as well.
Okay, now there's a couple of proposals that would actually deal with the criminal law, and they have direct implication on domestic violence. Would you tell us about those?
Sure, and I should preface what I'm going to talk about by saying that some of these bills, even though they're criminal issues, I do think they, especially for domestic and sexual violence victims, there's so much impact in terms of how they can move beyond the violence and the abuse and have healthy lives. So that's why I follow these. And I should also say that whenever you're addressing an issue like in the criminal code where you're adding a provision or trying to improve, there is a fiscal impact to those types of bills which could prevent them from being passed, especially in this atmosphere of budget cutting. So I wanted to preface that. You may not hear about these bills this year after all.
Okay.
So one is adding strangulation to our criminal code. It is a serious crime. I think everyone would agree that that's a serious crime, but we don't have a separate code section to charge strangulation. And the significance of that is that often there are, well, with strangulation, there are some serious injuries that can occur that you might not see right away, like a hoarse voice and broken voice box, bruises, and those types of injuries that may not appear right away, so when a hearing might be occurring, but they're long-lasting injuries. And frankly, if someone is strangling you, they are attempting to kill you. And so if you don't have a statute or a provision that considers this type crime a felony, that means that these charges are charged as misdemeanors with lower penalties.
So if an abuser is basically trying to strangle a victim, and there's no specific statute that deals with, quote, strangulation, so what are they, in fact, charged with?
They would probably be charged with assault and battery against a family or household member, or just if there is no family or household member relationship, and I'm going to talk about that in a minute, it would just be assault.
And so, what is the usual penalty for if you're found guilty of an assault or an assault and battery of that nature?
Well, it also depends on whether it's your first offense. If it is your first offense and you're over 18, you are often put into deferred sentencing, where if you basically are of good behavior over the next couple of years and don't violate any bond conditions, that conviction is kind of held over your head and then it's erased from your record. But if you are convicted, I mean, it really depends on the circumstances, but usually it's 12 months or less.
So I gather your position is that strangulation or attempted strangulation, if it's a very serious offense, I mean, you could kill somebody.
Exactly.
And it needs to be treated a lot more seriously than it is now.
Exactly. And there are other states, even states close to us, that have separate provisions to cover strangulation. For example, in North Carolina, they have a statute that says unless the conduct is covered under some other provision of law providing greater punishment, any person who assaults another person and inflicts physical injury by strangulation is guilty of a Class H felony. So I definitely understand the impact that that would have, adding something like that to Virginia's code, financial resources, the resources of prosecuting those types of crimes as felonies, what would be involved in longer felony types of convictions and sentences, jail time, all of that.
But nonetheless, we are talking about protecting victims of domestic violence.
Exactly.
Here. Well, you mentioned also a proposal to deal with protective orders and post-cohabitation charge. What's all that about?
Let me explain that a little further. I mentioned before the family or household member relationship. In Virginia, if you fall within that category of being a family or household member, you can seek a certain type of protective order called a family abuse protective order. And if there is a companion criminal case, it's going to be the assault and battery of a family or household member. So who qualifies as a family or household member?
There's a long list.
There's a long list, including things you would probably assume, like a spouse or a former spouse, people that you have a child in common with. The cohabitation one I'm talking about is people who have cohabitated, meaning living together as husband and wife, having sexual relations, doing laundry for each other. That is cohabitating and doing so within the last 12 months. So what happens, there's two issues I'll talk about. One is, what happens in a scenario like the following, where there are several assaults of a victim? There is the requisite family or household member relationship in that they had lived together within the last 12 months. Just at 12 months and a day, another assault happens. The problem with that is, this is what I mean by post-cohabitation. So it's beyond the statute's definition of a family or household member relationship. So it would be heard in general district court, as opposed to juvenile and domestic relations court, where all of the other assaults had been heard. If there was the remaining family or household member relationship, that subsequent assault would probably be considered at a felony level, or there would be a higher penalty. Because it is kicked out to general district court, you're starting anew with new judges, as if this is the first time that's ever happened.
And is there no mechanism by which the prior history in the juvenile domestic relations court can sort of be brought over to the general district court, so that the general district court judge knows, hey, this is not the first time this fellow has done this to her. This is like the third or fourth time. There's no mechanism for doing that right now?
I think that would require a lot of advocacy on behalf of the victim in working with the Commonwealth Attorney's Office. And frankly, I think they are constricted by these statutes and having to consider it a new assault. Maybe that testimony might come in if the witness, for example, the victim herself is testifying. However, that's not going to change how that charge was originally made as an assault against a person.
Okay. So what's the proposal here basically is to amend who is considered a household member if you've basically been cohabitating.
Right. To maybe add to the long list that we refer to of folks who qualify as family or household members, anyone who is currently protected by a protective order or something like that, to sort of extend the benefits of the family or household member relationship.
And just for the benefit of our listeners, how long can a protective order under current law last?
Under current law, if you go through the protective order process and are able to prove that a protective order should be issued on your behalf, it can be for up to 2 years. If it's violated and there is a conviction for that violation, and it has to be a specific type of violation, not just sort of lesser violations, for example, another assault, then there would be a prosecution of that charge, and also in the conviction process, a new protective order would be issued. So it's possible that a person, say, halfway through, like a year into their 2-year protective order, there's a violation of their protective order, they would get another 2-year protective order.
Okay. Well, I know that you're working with the Virginia Sexual and Domestic Violence Action Alliance on a number of initiatives. Would you tell us about those?
Okay. The Virginia Sexual and Domestic Violence Action Alliance is kind of our counterpart with sexual and domestic violence agencies around the state. So anyway, they are working on a proposal. Actually, these are proposals that have come up in the past. One is to increase the marriage license fee to cover children's services, children who find themselves with their parents, the healthy victim parent, in a shelter or a program. And the significance of that is that we are finding through studies and scientific research that children who witness domestic violence really suffer from that actual exposure. I've actually been to several really illuminating trainings where they talked about studying the brain function of kids who are exposed to domestic violence as opposed to kids who were actually abused and neglected themselves. So the exposure, the damage in brain function tends to be greater, if you can believe it, in children who are exposed to domestic violence as opposed to children who are abused themselves. And so the point, and from some of these trainings, some of the therapies and services that can help these types of children are things like engaging in physical activity, dance, sports, etc. So that child can develop a mastery of skills, and that not only helps them cope with what they're witnessing, it helps actually repair brain function. So those types of services are difficult for a lot of the programs to find resources for. Increasing the marriage license fee, and the proposal is to put some of it toward court costs, going to the clerk's offices, and some of it toward these programs to increase children's services.
So this sounds similar to what we in legal aid call the filing fee add-on, where every time a civil case, a non-criminal case, gets filed in Virginia courts, there's $5 added on to the fee, and part of that money is used for civil legal aid. I gather this would be sort of a similar funding mechanism.
Exactly. It would be very similar. The marriage license fee, I believe, is only $35, and it's one of the lowest in the country, and it has not been increased in decades.
So even a modest increase would certainly add a great deal of revenue. Any idea how much revenue would be added by an increase?
I honestly don't know the answer to that question. That's a good question for me to explore before I go up to the General Assembly.
All right. Well, let's go to other issues that will be brought before the General Assembly. I gather there is a proposal dealing with immigrants who are victims of domestic violence.
Yes, this is another bill that was introduced in the past, and the idea is that when immigrants who have witnessed certain crimes are interviewed, that the law enforcement officers or prosecutors who are doing that interviewing are not asking those victims or those witnesses about their immigration status. And the point of that is that many immigrant communities, even immigrants who are here legally, say with a green card or an active visa, have a distrust of law enforcement and prosecution based on potentially their countries of origin, potentially how they've been treated here in Virginia. So the idea is, if we want to encourage cooperation between witnesses and law enforcement agencies, how about not asking for that information when you're interviewing them, when you're working with them about being a witness?
So I gather we've really got sort of two competing interests here. I mean, obviously there are folks who want to enforce the immigration laws, make sure that folks who are here are documented. But at the same time, we want to solve crime. And I gather those two interests butt heads from time to time.
Right. They can butt heads. I think the reason they might butt heads is because of, honestly, a lack of involvement, a lack of community relationships between law enforcement agencies and immigrant communities. So some of that, I think, if those community relationships could be built, you wouldn't really be addressing this, and law enforcement agents would recognize, you know, if I want to prosecute or investigate this crime, what can I do to make that easier for this witness?
And really, when law enforcement is investigating a crime, whether it's domestic violence or some other crime, and people from immigrant communities are involved, I mean, is there really any legitimate interest to ask the victim or the witnesses about their immigration status, about whether they do or do not have documentation?
No, there isn't. In any case, a Virginia law enforcement agency would not have a lot of authority about pursuing deportation procedures, anything like that. These are federal types of remedies for law enforcement. So really, there isn't any reason.
And I guess the other issue that you've been working with the Virginia Sexual and Domestic Violence Action Alliance on is another issue dealing with protective orders. And this is kind of an unusual issue, but I know there's a very serious side to this. Tell us about this.
Yes, this is also a bill that was introduced in the past, and it's to add to the number of types of relief you can get through a protective order, protecting the victim's pet, a companion, usually a companion pet. And there was a lot of sort of giggling and laughter in the past during testimony. But there is a very strong tie between violence to a pet or animal and violence to victims. Oftentimes, for example, an abuser might say, if you leave me, I'm going to harm the dog. I have heard of hideous examples where for example, the abuser knew where the victim had gone to after leaving their home, sent the dog's ear, having cut it off. I mean, these are horrible ways to manipulate and control a victim. And it's also animal abuse. So a proposal would be to add, among the number of enumerated types of relief, that you can get protection for your pet or companion animal.
So in other words, I mean, under current law, obviously a protective order can do a great deal. It can obviously have a no contact between the parties. It can give the victim exclusive use of the home, a vehicle, child custody, things of that nature. But if abuser is subject to a protective order and they go and torture the family pet or do something horrible, that would not be considered a violation of the protective order under current law, I gather.
Well, you bring up a good point, because I think, opponents of the bill, and these may be opponents who are on the side of protecting domestic violence victims, they might say, well, the current protective order statute has catch-all relief. It has a separate provision for what they call catch-all relief, which is, well, like it sounds, anything. You would have to put on evidence of why you're asking for that particular relief in your protective order case. So that would be a reason to not add the pet concept to the enumerated list of remedies. You can already get it if you put on evidence. On the other hand, I do think in many jurisdictions there are judges who really look at that list and say, you know, it doesn't say it here in the statute, so I'm not going to be able, I hear your evidence about it and I understand, but I'm not going to be able to issue that type of a provision in this order.
So basically you define it, you make it clear, and the judge can order it.
Right. Exactly.
Well, thanks for being with us, Sushila. We have been talking with Virginia Poverty Law Center attorney Sushila Varkey about domestic violence issues confronting the General Assembly next year. This is the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. That's all for this week's Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. This show is heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. The show is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. To see if you can get free civil legal aid, call during intake hours. These are Monday through Thursday, 9 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. and 1 p.m. to 2:30 p.m. The phone number is 200-6046 for intake, 648-1012 for the main number, and 1-800-868-1012 to call toll-free. If you have any comments on the show, you can email them to marty@cvlas.org. In addition, every first-run Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio show ever broadcast is now available at www.radioforall.net. That's radio, the numeral 4, all.net. Then click the contributor link, then click Marty Wegbright, Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. This show provides only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford one, call Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. If you're found or plead guilty to a crime, you may lose more than just your liberty or your right to vote. Join us next Wednesday at 12:30 p.m. when our guest, criminal defense lawyer Esther Windmuller, reveals the troubling civil consequences of a criminal conviction in a rebroadcast of a show originally heard on October 8, 2008. That's Law for the Rest of Us next week on the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. I'm Marty Wegbright.
Well, that was awesome, if I do say so myself. Thank you very much to Marty and his guests. It was enlightening. There's clapping abound. And you're listening to WRIR LP 97.3 FM, Richmond's Indie Radio, and the City of Richmond's official emergency broadcast outlet. Let me go ahead and get some promos in the mix, shall we?
Ladies and gentlemen, WRIR is very excited and proud to present An Afternoon with Harry Shearer. What did he just say? That's right, An Afternoon with Harry Shearer. Join us at the Bird Theater on Sunday, November 22nd, for an afternoon with the satirical mastermind and political commentator behind Les Show. Harry Shearer is also the man behind the mustache of Derek Smalls, the bassist for the legendary and loudest band in the world, Spinal Tap, and the voice behind the many characters of The Simpsons, including Mr. Burns and Ned Flanders. Mr. Shearer's presentation will be followed by a 25th anniversary screening of the quintessential Rock-U mockumentary, This Is Spinal Tap, with an introduction by Harry himself. That's An Afternoon with Harry Shearer, sponsored in part by Arius Remodel and Design, The Camel, Chop Suey Books,
Fast Mart, Millie's Diner, Snake Oil Recording, and Style Weekly. For information and to purchase your tickets, please visit WRIR.org or visit Plan 9 in Carytown. An Afternoon with Harry Shearer on Sunday, November 22nd. I'll see you there.